When I left my home and family, I was no more than a boy in the company of strangers, in the quiet of a railway station, running scared.
Good morning, George.
Good morning.
Well, we have on the phone with us on a special segment of In Your Corner, award-winning sports journalist George Kimball, who has written a wonderful book called Four Kings, Leonard, Hagler, Hearns, Duran, and the Last Great Era of Boxing. I'm here with my co-host, John Spehar of Fighting Fitness.
Good morning, Benny. Good morning, George.
Hey, good morning, John. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
Yeah, we've got a blizzard out here. Where are you in the city?
I am. It's not quite a blizzard yet, but there's snow flurrying around.
So tell us, one thing I was delighted to read in your book, Four Kings, is about four guys that you feel constitute a kind of golden era of boxing. I believe they were all middleweights, and you talk a lot about, and they actually fought each other. You talk about their mentors, their trainers. What drew you to this particular golden era, what you call the last great era of boxing?
Well, I covered all nine fights between the four guys, among other things. I mean, I covered 90 fights in that decade. But with the passage of time, it became, I mean, we knew these were big events at the time, but that it constituted a self-contained era probably didn't become clear until much later on. And once I'd retired from my newspaper job and was kind of interested in writing some books, I started trying to think about things, and once I kind of hit upon this, I'd saved all kinds of clippings and notes from my own coverage, and it was kind of a book that wrote itself. Once the format was clear, because it's the kind of thing that it's very unlikely. It had happened before in boxing, but it's very likely to be repeated again, that you'd have four great Hall of Famers fighting each other in this round-robin series nine times over a decade.
George, I think what was remarkable, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that every night that these guys got in the ring together was a super fight. And we're talking about now here in this current era where, you know, you need 3 weeks of an HBO promotion like De La Hoya, Mayweather 24/7, to get people excited about a fight. This was before pay-per-view was kind of an ongoing thing. And I remember seeing Hagler and Leonard in a little hall in Maine. They sold out the hall. This is very much an era where there was closed-circuit TV, and there was a buzz about the fights, and it was almost palpable. It wasn't quite, I don't know if commercial is the right word, but I think there was a sense of excitement about all four of these guys.
Well, there certainly was, and it's as I say, it was a different time and a different era. I think there are a number of reasons why you had that. One is that in those days, the network showed a lot of weekend afternoon boxing programming. So that as they fought their way up through the ranks, all four of these guys had actually appeared on numerous occasions on network television, so that the people knew who they were and were familiar with them, and once they got to big time fights and fights against each other, people were very anxious to see them. And the other thing is, as you said, there was this great anticipation about all these fights, because even the couple that turned out to be pretty one sided going into the fight, there was a real sense that either guy could win it, that they were very competitive fights. I mean, even the Hearns-Duran fight, which in retrospect was a fight just on physical gifts alone, Tommy was probably going to win every time.
Right.
But there was a real sense that Duran had a chance to win that fight. And and even in his third fight with Leonard, where they had, you know, it's 8 years after or 9 years after they'd fought the first two times, but there was a lot of smart money that thought Duran had a chance to win that fight.
You know, we had Angelo Dundee on the program, and people think of him primarily as Muhammad Ali's trainer, of course, but he also trained Sugar Ray Leonard.
He trained him for almost all of his career. He was with him right up through the Hagler fight. He wasn't with him for the last two fights I described, the second Hearns fight and the third Duran fight. They'd kind of parted ways over contractual issues and money. I think Angelo just kind of felt disrespected at that by Mike Trainer, Ray's lawyer. But what was that? What had happened back then is of course that once the money just started getting outrageous, and we were talking about multi-million-dollar purses, there was some question: a trainer's worth 10% of your purse, but he's worth 10% of a $10 million purse.
Right.
And when they started trying to renegotiate those things, Don Angelo finally just walked away. I mean, he and Ray remained on friendly terms personally. There was some animosity with Mike Trainer, but he didn't train for Ray for those last two fights.
I think that's fair to say that Emmanuel Stewart had a similar issue with Tommy Hearns.
Well, that was much later after the... it was a different kind of issue with Tommy. Emmanuel stayed with Tommy through all of these fights, through this era. And when Tommy kept fighting on in the 80s, I think it was less over money than the fact that Emmanuel really would have preferred that Tommy stop boxing. And Tommy wanted to fight. Tommy fought well into his 40s. And would probably still be fighting if he had broken a leg a couple of years ago.
I think I think
that was really the issue there is that Emmanuel really thought it was unwise for him to keep boxing.
I think it's fair to say that when we look back in retrospect, that these guys were amazing in their prime. And three out of the four did the exact same thing that most fighters do. And that is they all stayed a little bit too long. And
yeah, they did, and that happens far more often than not. And the fact of the matter is that we look back at it now as at Marvin Hagler as having made a very wise decision by walking away more or less at the top of his game after losing a very hotly disputed decision to Leonard, and he never boxed again. But the fact is, he was tempted a couple of times. It was what was as big a consideration in Marvin's mind is that no matter how much money he was going to make out of the rematch, he knew Ray was going to make even more, and that by not agreeing to a rematch, he was denying Leonard another big payday.
Well, I talk a lot about that. I talked about the De La Hoya Mayweather fight, and I said, they tried to create all this animosity, all this hostility, all this rivalry that I didn't think was necessarily there. But it's very clear in your book that some of these guys, the Hagler-Hearns fight, which we'll talk about in a second. But I think that if you look across the ring at a guy and you know that in about a half hour or 45 minutes you're going to make him a multimillionaire, you have to have some kind of feeling for him. You have to have a certain amount of affection for him.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that, there was a great deal of respect between all of these guys. And there was some, I don't know if you'd really even call it personal, but there was a long history, as I described, in the relationship between Hagler and Leonard, going back to 1973, when in their amateur days, and Marvin had turned pro right after winning the AAU title in '73, and fought his first pro fight for $40. Ray waited till after the 1976 Olympics, which was the year that the U.S. won five gold medals. It was a huge marquee event, and Ray was pretty much the poster boy for the Olympics on ABC. So everybody in America knew who he was. The networks were fighting over him. And so when Leonard made his pro debut 3 years after Hagler did, he made $40,000 for his first fight. And and there was always kind of this lingering resentment that, Marvin thought Ray was slick, a pretty boy, and that he was getting a lot of recognition that Marvin felt would have been his due.
Yeah.
So, that was kind of lingering in the backdrop of all through the decade until they finally fought in 1987.
Slightly different tangent, but you mentioned 1973. Early on in your book, you recall in 1967, Marvin Hagler, who was from Newark, which, by the way,
yeah,
George, is my hometown. Marvin Hagler was 13 years old at the time that, and I have memories of this as well, of the the massive riots that erupted in Newark that gripped the city, as you say, for the better part of a week. There was looting. There were tanks coming up the streets. I mention this now because, you know, we're on the cusp of having our inauguration of the first African-American president. One of the things that you go into in this book that I'd like you to speak to a little bit is several of these guys, as recently as the 70s, were fighting incredible discrimination.
Yeah, they were. I would say that, you know, in a lot of ways, Leonard probably faced that less than some of the others. But there was certainly, yeah, there was unquestionably, you know, black boxers didn't get the same shake that white guys did in these things. But in the, I mean, the the Newark riots, which I mean, the participants describe it still as the rebellion rather than the riot.
Yes, but, right, for specific reasons too. Yeah,
it was. I mean, I had heard these stories. You know, Marvin and his mother had described the scene to me several times about how bullets literally crashing through the windows, and the kids were ordered to crawl around on the floor when they went from room to room because she didn't want them standing up in front of the window, and they were kind of trapped in their own home for days and days. And it was about a year and a half ago, right? Actually, I was well into writing the book, and I happened to be at a poetry reading down at St. Mark's with a Mary Baraka, who was still known as Leroy Jones at the time back in the 60s, but he was a Newark product, and he had moved from New York back to Newark, and actually got arrested during those riots. The charges were later dropped on it, and I just happened to mention to him that Marvin had been from there, and he told me the story. He said, don't I know that? It turned out that his mother, that the then Leroy Jones' mother, was actually the social worker who supervised the project where Marvin and his family lived, and it was she who helped May, Marvin's mother, relocate to Brockton after the Newark riots.
That's so interesting. And yeah, Mary Baraka / Leroy Jones went to the high school I went to, Weequahic High School. And you're so right to mention the idea of the rebellion, because in authors writing about that history, that piece of history, you know, they stress that this was just not some kind of spontaneous combustion. There was a series of inequities perpetrated by the Newark police that people were concerned with.
Oh, absolutely.
And it really turned things around in Newark in such a strange way, you know.
Last month I was back over in Newark. They had the first title fight since, I think it's in nearly 60 years since Tony Zale and Rocky Graziano fought there and they in that new Prudential Center. And it was a smashing success. It's a great place to watch a fight. And so now Thomas Adamack is going to defend his cruiserweight title there again next month. So there's going to be another fight there in February.
So you're covering a lot of fights?
Yeah, I don't get on airplanes to go to most of them anymore. But I go to most of the ones in New York, and occasionally get up to the ones in Connecticut and Newark. Of course, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump across the river, so it's pretty easy to get to.
All right. So now here comes the moment of truth.
Da,
George,
da, da, da.
We had Bert Sugar on the show. He and I disagreed vehemently on this issue. My feeling regarding Hagler and Leonard was to take a title away from a man like Marvelous Marvin Hagler, you had to beat him, not run from him in boxing spurts. Bert's contention was quite simply, he outboxed him, that's it, it's it, that's that. What do you think?
I think that what happened is Ray really understood the mechanics of how a boxing match is scored better than Marvin did, and was able to take advantage of that and to sort of, you know, even manipulate it in some cases. In rounds that were very close, he had Ollie Dunlap had a stopwatch in the corner and was alerting him when 30 seconds were left in a round, so that in a very close round, Ray knew to flurry, because those last 30 seconds were, you know, in a round where not much else had happened, those last 30 seconds were what the judges were going to remember. And he, you know, he was able to do it like that. I don't think Marvin really understood that each round is scored separately by three different judges, and it's a cumulative total that works. Now, had this fight occurred back in the old days, when the referee was the only one who made the decision, your contention would be absolutely right. He didn't do enough to take the title from the champion. At the end of the fight, the referee would have held Hagler's hand up. But under the rules they were playing by, Ray won enough rounds, won more rounds than Marvin did, even though Marvin probably landed the harder punches through most of the fight.
Well, it's funny. On the HBO special Legendary Nights, there's a lot of audio from that fight, and you hear Hagler just berating Leonard for not fighting.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, come at me. Come on. Let's do this. And Ray just smiled, and you're absolutely right, waited for the 30-second flurry. And I like the throwback fights. I think possibly the last great middleweight era we had prior to the one that you've written about is the Zale, Graciano, that particular era when we had the LaMottas, the Ray Robinsons, I mean, everybody.
Yeah, well, I mean, those, you know, everybody has his own favorite era. That was certainly a great one. And you know, some of the fights from that era were mindful of these. Certainly the Hagler-Hearns fight had people talking about those fights. It's funny, I was talking to my friend Pete Hamill, who wrote the foreword to this book yesterday. We had lunch, and we were talking about some of the Robinson fights, and I was explaining that I was a kid and was out of the country for some of his great fights, and that by the time I got back and saw the end of Ray's career, he was pretty much all done. I mean, the two losses to Paul Pender, for instance. I mean, he was no longer Sugar Ray Robinson.
Well, I think it's fair to say that when we watched, you know, a much diminished Sugar Ray Leonard fight the likes of Terry Norris, who I don't think would have lasted very long when in Ray's prime, and then lose an unremarkable fight due to a twisted ankle to a, you know, flashy but ineffective Macho Camacho, I think the same thing happened. I think, you know, there's a remarkable parallel to the end of the careers of both Sugars.
Yeah, there is. I mean, it was, you know, and it's always, I don't know about you, but I mean, it's always very sad to see, to watch those kind of things happen. I mean, in Leonard's case, it was, you know, it was all quite abrupt because he lost those two fights. I mean, there were both fights that I really thought he could win, and he lost them both convincingly and really just, you know, showed nothing in those fights. Duran, it was more gradual because Duran kept fighting for a long time. He fought beyond his 50th birthday, and he was beating guys he should have beat. And then every once in a while, he'd try and make some money, and he'd get in with a guy who could beat him, and it'd be another loss. But that went on for such a protracted period of time that it wasn't quite the same as you know, the kind of shock and awe at watching the disintegration of Leonard.
I think, you know, what's real sad to see, and I think that, you know, in the long run, who won, who lost. But I think the condition of Tommy Hearns right now, and I think Tommy fought up until last year, is that correct?
Well, it was 2 or 3 years ago, yeah.
2 or 3 years ago, and he was on the undercard with his son. And it just seemed to be such a bizarre turn of events for
Tommy,
a great fighter.
There's a difference. I mean, there is no doubt that his speech has been affected.
Right.
And that does happen. But I've honestly seen no evidence of any sort of cognitive impairment. I mean, he's as bright as he ever was. I mean, Tommy was never a great speaker anyway, but his voice and his diction has certainly changed. But I'm thinking back to, even with Ali, which is, you know, Ali, you start to wonder how much of this is ring damage and how much of it is Parkinson's, which,
right,
you know, which people who never boxed have gotten to. But there was a time when Ali was, you know, he hadn't lost a thing mentally, but his speech and his motor he had some motor difficulties unless he took his medication, and his speech was kind of, you know, it was very, very hard for him to speak at all. But so people assumed that, well, he's not all there. But of course he was. I mean, I saw ample evidence of that. And I'd seen the same thing with Tommy. I was with him just a couple of months ago up in Montreal when Ronald fought on an undercard up there. And, you know, I would say I really don't see any cognitive damage, but there's no question that his speech was, you know, was affected. Well, and that happened, you know, probably 10 years ago it began to happen.
Right.
George, one final question. We're talking with George Kimball, author of Four Kings, Leonard Hagler, Hearns, Duran, and the Last Great Era of Boxing. The book is great. It has a foreword by Pete Hamill. How has boxing journalism changed? Are you doing a lot of writing these days for the internet sites?
Yeah, well, I do write for ESPN.com, and I had a couple of websites I was working for before that, before I came to that job. But there's a lot of this is going on. I think it's the last refuge for guys my age who, you know, kind of as newspaper coverage has shrunk and guys have retired, it's a good way to keep our hand in. But it's changed a lot the way that fights are covered now. Because back in those days, in the days of the fights I'm talking about, I'd often get out to those fights 5-6 days ahead of time, and you'd spend all week at the venue watching the boxers
and training,
there would be great sessions with the trainers and cornermen and officials in the bars, and you learn that way. Today, you know, there might be a big conference call a few days before a fight, a big gangbang press conference maybe the day before, where, you know, it's just a mass interview. So it's not only that the writers don't get to know the fighters and the principals, but the fighters don't know who the writers are either.
Right. All right. Benny has given me permission to ask you this last question. It's a yes or a no, and have you ever seen, now, you and I, you were at this fight. I was on the edge of my seat during this fight, and I'm sure everyone in America who saw this fight were too. This is, we're talking about the Hearns Hagler, the three rounds of fury, easily the most ferocious three rounds in middleweight history. Do you agree or not agree, George?
I think it's the greatest short fight in boxing history.
Excellent. I was right. I knew you'd say that.
We like to be in agreement. Well, George Kimball, it's been a delight. We hope you'll come back in the future with other efforts that you may get involved with.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for coming on the program.
George, great having you. I've enjoyed the book immensely. I can't wait to meet you sometime.
Okay, great, John.
Take care.
Take care.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. And that was George Kimball, Four Kings, Leonard Hagler, Hearns Duran, and The Last Great Era of Boxing. John, a pleasure as always.
Benny Klein, every time we have a rematch on something interesting happens.
It's so true. We'll be back. John Spihar, co-owner of Fighting Fitness, and does work for the Bridgeport Sound Tigers. It's 5 of 11. Coming up at 11 is my interview with Harry Shearer, who I believe is going to be speaking with me from Hollywood, or at the very least L.A., about an art installation at the Aldrich Museum of Contemporary Art. We are WPKN in Bridgeport. Please stay tuned.